Hi, I'm Kay Jabelli.
I'm Frieza Bastoon, and this is Monopoly Attack.
Today we'll be talking about the Digital Markets Act, or DMA, this revolutionary regulatory instrument that the European Commission has proposed. But since there's so much to go through, we're splitting the discussion into three parts.
In this first episode, we'll talk about the background of the DMA and discuss which online platforms it will or could apply to.
In part two, we'll talk about the specific obligations and prohibitions that will apply once the DMA is in force.
In the final part three, we'll talk about defenses, the enforcement of DMA, and the role of member states within that enforcement.
What is the Digital Markets Act, Frieza?
Well, where to start? So it's a new instrument. Well, it's a new proposed instrument that, as the name implies, regulates digital markets, but interestingly, it regulates, well, the competitive relations in those markets between the players we all know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, but it doesn't do so through the traditional way, competition law, but goes one step further and rather wants to perhaps not just protect, but even promote competition in those markets. Is that a fair characterization, Kay?
I think so, but it's leaves some ambiguity there. What's a digital market, Frieza?
Oh, they have to go that far back. Well, the DMA, Digital Markets Act, in other words, focuses on these platform services, so these digital intermediaries, for example, an app store, a cloud service, a digital marketplace, such as Amazon's. It's a bit of a, you know it when you see it.
It does cover a large range of digital services. I do think that when they talk about regulating the digital economy, they really are talking about platforms primarily. Interestingly, there is this distinction between transaction platforms and innovation platforms. Transaction platforms are where the main value that's being added is really this connection that's being created between one side of a market and another side of a market, and how that connection is being intermediated. And then on an innovation platform, though, it's not so much about the connection. It's more about creating common standards that everyone can innovate atop of. So standard essential patents, operating systems as well, as opposed to, say, an app store where you are having app developers who are reaching end customers. So both of those are being lumped in. There is some commonality in that there are network effects. And when digital is concerned, data is very important. So there's also a bit of something else, and you hinted at this idea that the competition law didn't go far enough. What else would you add on that, Frieza?
Maybe first I would add a third category, but I think maybe you've covered this with transaction platforms, is these advertising platforms where there's no literal transaction, no money changing hands between the two sides, but rather the advertiser paying for access to these consumers that are on the platform for some other reason, to see their friends on Facebook, to search for something on Google. And I guess that covers sort of all the platforms that are covered here. But you're right that it goes beyond competition law, but the difficult thing is to say how exactly it does, because it refers to fairness. I mean, a word we're hearing more and more these last couple of years in competition enforcement as well. But obviously, it's a bit less defined than the words we're used to, such as undistorted competition. We sort of know what that means by now. And it adds another word, which is contestability. So the idea that competitors shouldn't be let free to compete with the incumbent platforms, but maybe that competition should even be facilitated by, well, the government, in this case, the European Commission.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. The title of the whole proposal is the regulation of the uncontestable and fair markets in the digital sector. So it's two main objectives, contestability and fairness. We'll talk about more specifically what does that mean, how is that defined, what's the history of those terms a little bit later. I mean, the Commission has gone around and very much been saying that the existing competition tools haven't really achieved the expected overall market effects that they were hoping to get. Now, there's various interpretations of why that is. One could be they didn't have very good theories of harm or good theories of products. So when they impose some of these interventions, they might not have taken into account all the circumstances that would have really made the difference in the market that they were expecting. We talked a little bit about that last time. There's also the other one of maybe, well, if they're thinking of certain outcomes that they're trying to achieve, certain market shares that they think are fair for competitors to have, maybe that's not the competition tools aren't the best tools to achieve those kind of outcomes. The competition tools, and we talked about this last week as well, are really a little bit more about trying to make sure the competitive process is working. And that's not necessarily going to let you pick winners and losers. The market is still ultimately what's supposed to be picking the winners and losers under a competitive, effective competition.
I mean, where I am in that debate is I think competition law is one of the most flexible areas of law we got. So there are new forms of anti-competitive conduct, of course, engaged in by these platforms. But I think competition law is up to the task substantively as to what it can do. I think the deficiencies of competition law, if any, is more in the institutional framework. I mean, competition law by definition is exposed. You only intervene after a certain type of conduct has taken place. And we've seen from decisions like Google Shopping that can take up to 7 years from when they start looking at a certain type of conduct to all the way to come into their decision. And I guess that's maybe the biggest deficiency, this lack of speed, especially in a world where everything moves very fast and 2 or 3 years can already cement a dominant position in this new adjacent platform market that's been entered into by the platform in a potentially anti-competitive way. That's why this ex ante instrument, something that applies before it is even found or noticed that this conduct is anti-competitive, that might remedy the lack of speed that we see in competition law.
I do question that premise a little bit. Yes, it does take time, but we talked about some of these interim measures cases that happen very quickly. With competition law, it can be applied more quickly. But those theories of harm and really understanding how the new economy works and how foreclosure strategies can be implemented in the new economy, that's true. Being able to detect them is even harder, and it does move quickly. So regardless of how quickly the enforcer moves, the economy moves a lot quickly online, and that is also makes it more of a challenge itself. So I think those many, many competition policy reports that came out over the last years, they did really emphasize the speed aspect and the information asymmetry. So, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of recommendations of how to address that. One has been, for example, to shift the burden of proof. So instead of having the enforcer having to come in and prove the anti-competitive harm, as well as all the other constituent elements of a competition claim, which are, you know, market definition, market power, anti-competitive effect, lack of objective justification, that's a lot of stuff, a lot of burden that a lot of these reports were recommending can be shifted and say, well, actually, maybe the defendant needs to prove something. Now, in criminal law, Frizo, is it innocent until proven guilty or guilty until proven innocent?
It is innocent until proven guilty, if I remember correctly. Of course, yeah, that brings us to the debate whether competition law is criminal law. Some would say yes, and some courts have hinted at that, given the size of the sanctions. But yeah, I think we're still more in a business law context where at least it's a bit less controversial to shift that burden.
I think if you were going to say, look, this is only about economic changes. It's not about sanctions, right? We're not going to fine the company if they've done something wrong without us having to prove it. But we want to have control over our economy. We want to determine the appropriate distribution of rents. So that's makes sense. If it's not criminal, right? If it's just economic, then you're using it as economic regulation. That kind of makes sense. So speed, information asymmetries, potentially shifting the burden of proof. Then we had all these other aspects of these competition policy reports as well, which were coming up with new theories of harm, which ended up giving rise to a lot of cases that we talked about in the previous episode. But that's not the end of the story, because we have the DMA as well, right?
I mean, there's also a whole question about how do you change, shift this burden of proof? How do you come up with new presumptions to change the standards of proof? That debate is sort of going on in parallel, but there's been less results from that. An area where there is results is this, well, what the commission calls a complementary instrument, namely the Digital Markets Act. And some of what is in the act overlaps with competition law, so that's another thing we have to get into later. But some of it is clearly different, like I said earlier, not just protecting competition, but even promoting it. So maybe we should talk about the scope of the instrument, like who does it apply to exactly?
So like you said, it's an instrument. It's a regulatory instrument. It's an ex ante regulatory instrument. So it's something new coming along, and it's not competition enforcement. And so one of the ways they're addressing this question of speed is that there's a prior designation. So you're going to say we don't need to do market definition. We don't need to show market power anymore. We know who we want to target. These are the companies that are above a certain threshold. And in this case, there's sort of two criteria here. There's, do you have a core platform service? And is your core platform service of the right economic scope? So first is the list of the core platform services. It starts off with a catch-all, which is online intermediation, which the horizontal regulation that they passed last year, the platform to business regulation, it uses that definition, which covers a wide range of platforms that offer any sort of intermediation between businesses and consumers. Then it goes on to add in...
any kind of platform.
Yeah, basically any kind of platform. But then they go on to add a little bit more specifically, which maybe makes sense because then they say, well, online search engines. Now in P2B as well, they had to sort of clarify that online search engines, to the extent that they're webs, they're not having a commercial relationship with the universe of websites, but they do provide a service to them by indexing them and putting them on the search engine. So it's not a contractual relationship, but it's still a considered an intermediation that they're doing. And then social media, video sharing platforms, messaging services, operating systems. Then it gets a little bit more interesting because they've got cloud computing. We talked about that, but it's not exactly the same as the others, but it's in there as well. And then they also add in advertising services when provider of one of these other ones. So it's sort of making sure that the advertising service of a search engine or the advertising service of a social media network, Google, Facebook, that their advertising services are going to be caught as well.
Yeah, I mean, this whole sort of list-based approach is interesting. Like everything in the DMA should be about speed and immediate certainty. So rather just saying this applies to platforms or innovation, advertising and transaction platforms, they're like, it applies to platforms and specifically you and you and you and you and you. So that should make it easier for those platforms concerned. And hopefully that works out. But it's not just any kind of platform. There's a second criterion added to that, which is that these platforms need to be gatekeepers. And what's that about?
So the gatekeeper criteria is the sort of the economic scope. Are they big enough that they are a concern? Now, there is the three-step test or three-part test. They have to have a significant impact on the internal market, which is basically based around their turnover, their revenues, or market cap, or their fair market value. And these numbers are pretty high, 6.5 billion European turnover, or sort of 65 billion market cap. So there's a handful of companies that are going to be falling under this. Then there's the platform service itself needs to be quote-unquote, important gateway for business users to reach end users. And that's if they have 10% of the European populations as active end users. So that's 45 million. And on the other side of the platform, 10,000 yearly active business users. So that you're of big enough scale, you have enough users on each side of your platform that this is going to apply to you. And then the third criteria is that they have an entrenched and durable position, which is basically that they have met that important gateway criteria, but the number of users for the last 3 years. And then what's interesting about these bits is that there is, for both the core platform service, the product scope, and the economic scope, IMCO has put out these amendments, draft amendments still. They're not final, but they have been published. Now, IMCO, the Internal Market Committee, they have primary responsibility for the legislation. And that's because, in large part, that the TFEU, the treaty Article 114 was used. Now, Article 114 is a legal basis for new laws. So the treaty, it's like the Constitution. It defines what kind of additional powers the Commission has, what kind of laws can be passed and imposed across Europe, and what the legal basis, what is the scope of that power to legislate. And under 114, the legal basis of the DMA, the scope is to harmonize the rules in the single market. So it's traditionally been used to reduce diverging fragmentation of national approaches. You know, different member states are trying to regulate something in different ways that can be a barrier to trade, that can prevent cross-border trade. And so to really make sure there's a single market within Europe, then you want to have a European regulator who's going to harmonize these rules. So the technical justification for the DMA is we want to harmonize these rules to different platform conduct and in their impact report justifying the policy options that they've taken with the DMA proposal, they've cited things like the German amendments to competition law and other upcoming competition law amendments that they say justify, you know, the risk there being a fragmentation of approaches to platform services, national enforcement. And so that's why the IMCO committee has it. And the IMCO committee has now been the first to come out with proposed amendments. They say, well, let's narrow the product scope. So we actually only want to go after you if you operate two core platform services, not just one. So unless you have some kind of an ecosystem aspect to you, we're not so worried. And then on the economic scope, they've said, let's raise the fees. Now, what do you think about the thresholds? They've said, let's raise the thresholds. So they've said, instead of 6.5 billion turnover, 10 billion, or instead of 65 billion market cap, 100 billion market cap. What do you think about this, Friso?
That was an interesting twist in the whole story. Of course, this whole report is led by Andreas Schwab, who has an interesting history, has been criticizing tech for some time, and is now in charge. And he's been pretty clear in outlets like the Financial Times that really we're only concerned or interested in five or six companies, the biggest ones we've already mentioned, and the so-called GAFAM, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft. Of course, perhaps a bit poorly worded, certainly for friends on the other side of the Atlantic who, of course, see protectionism here. The question is also, I mean, which other platform would be included otherwise? I mean, Spotify is sort of the only one in Europe, I think, that is even potentially qualified as a gatekeeper. But even then, I think I saw some analysis that it would have fallen below the previous thresholds as well. So I'm not even exactly sure what this new threshold is excluding. I guess it makes it even more certain that it's just these five big US companies and not really anyone else.
I think he said in a recent Handelsblatt article that it's a signal that to the companies that a vast majority of them will not be affected. But that I still question. Like, yes, the direct effects will be on the big tech US companies, but the indirect effects, all the spillover effects, I think that we are going to see real impacts on the European platform economy, but we can get to that a little bit later. So how does the commission make a designation of a gatekeeper?
Right. So there's a whole process for that too, again, in the interest of speed and these information asymmetries. So interestingly, these companies themselves, these potential gatekeepers, are required to notify the commission if they operate these core platform services that meet those gatekeeper criteria. And it is in the commission who, based on the information provided, will decide whether that's actually the case, whether we are dealing with a gatekeeper here. So some benefits to this, again, in terms of information asymmetry, they'll have to bring the information. And of course, in return, they will know. I mean, the commission will designate them literally. So there will be little doubt in, if we think about a competition law context where the criterion, at least under Article 102, is market power, there's always some potential doubt there, especially if there hasn't been a previous decision. What you're going to do here is the opposite. Say, you're a gatekeeper. You'll know that now for some times. Is there a revision clause there?
I mean, I think that the commission is required to review the list of gatekeepers and their core platform services. I mean, I don't think there's that much bite to that. There's no, you know, if they don't do it, there's no real assessment of the market dynamics. Have they changed? There's no ability for the gatekeepers to petition the commission and say, hey, I'm not a gatekeeper anymore. So the point is, you've had that discussion, and it's not really much of a discussion. Like, you're above these thresholds, you're a gatekeeper, and now we can move on to the really meaty stuff.
The really meaty stuff. Actually, before we do, just one interesting analogy that wraps together some things we've been talking about is telecommunications. Like, all of these things I'm seeing in this Digital Market Act make me think of the telecom laws I've studied before. I mean, firstly, like you said, it's based on Article 114 TFEU. We want to harmonize this area, specifically promote competition in it. And in that area too, the commission set up this test, this three criteria test to see which markets needed this kind of approach. And it would then be the national regulators that looked at their national markets, saw which players had significant market power and designated them as such, and then imposed specific requirements, which again, we're seeing a DMA in Articles 5 and 6 where those obligations are. Article 5 says these are the kind of obligations that apply from day one do not need too much specification. These apply to the core services. Article 6, a bit more difficult, has these obligations that are more far-reaching, but the other side of that is that they need to be further specified, so they don't apply from day one. It has to be some kind of, well, hopefully dialogue or at least imposition of more specific obligations.
I think that it would have been nice if that was actually how, you know, I know that's how it's often described, but for example, the Article 6 obligations, they're directly applicable. So in a lot of the earlier versions, there was talk about, okay, there's a white list and there's a gray list and there's a black list. Normally, when you think of a white list, that's stuff that you're allowed to do. That's a safe harbor. So you don't have to worry about claims. There's nothing like that. There's no safe harbor here. And the gray list, the commission is not obliged to specify. The Article 6 obligations are directly applicable. And even some of the Article 5 obligations are somewhat ambiguous in terms of how you're supposed to comply with them. So it's not quite as straightforward as all that. And since they're all directly applicable and you can have a non-compliance infringement decision against you for Article 5 or Article 6 from the moment you're designated a gatekeeper and those conditions start to apply, I think it's quite more far-reaching than was anticipated originally or even is commonly perceived.
I mean, perhaps it is indeed directly applicable, but I cannot see a scenario where the commission does not further specify an obligation and then imposes a, you know, 10% of turnover fine for not meeting that obligation. So, I mean, I think the directly applicable is to be taken with a grain of salt. I don't think if Apple doesn't, for example, start interoperating with other app stores on day one that this instrument enters into force, I don't think a fine will immediately follow. I think the first step is always further specification, at least for those Article 6 obligations.
And as someone who has worked at a company, I would say it's always much more comfortable when that is written in the law rather than relying on the good faith of the enforcer, especially something where it's about your products, how you design your products, and this kind of stuff. That's a lot of uncertainty about will they, won't they, and it's not specified. So I think that's a big bit of leverage that the commission has. In theory, you could even go to the commission and say, oh, hey, you know, I'm not sure if this is compliant with one of the Article 6 obligations. Would you further specify? And the commission can say, no, I won't further specify, and actually, I'm going to find you as non-compliant. There's nothing in here to prevent the commission from doing that. So that kind of protection of your rights of defense is a little bit lacking in the current proposal as the commission proposed it.
I mean, yeah, the big backstop is, of course, being able to go to the courts afterwards. And I don't think they would sanction anything of the kind of situations we've discussed. So I guess, you know, the commission also has to be mindful of that.
But we shouldn't have to go to court. I mean, business, industry, anyone, you know, the regulator shouldn't be passing stuff and then saying, go ahead, test me, take me to court on this.
I think that's the whole point of judicial review. I mean, also in competition law, I mean, if every case is clear cut and there's never any need for judicial review, I don't think the competition authority is doing a good job.
I agree with you for competition enforcement. I don't agree with you for regulation.
Well, let's maybe look at some of these obligations before getting too caught up in here.
Well, hold on. Since we've gone for almost 30 minutes, maybe now is a good time to pause, and we can start off the next episode going into the specific prohibitions and obligations in detail.
You're right. That sounds great. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and hope to catch you for part 2.